going to move this, though. I just want you to know so I don't blast your ears. And tell me if I'm too loud or too quiet.
Actually, that's perfect. All right, today is October 27th, 2011. My name is Carolyn Conklin, and I'm interviewing Rebecca Jones. And our first question is just, can you tell me what is the contra dance?
What is the contra dance? Contra dancing has been around for close to, over 500 years. Contra dancing began, it was the common people's dance. It's what people danced at fairs, at festivals, in the streets. It's what the peasants danced in Europe. It was called contra dancing. Well, there's two theories. It's called contra dancing because in its oldest forms, the men lined up contra or across from the women. And so contra, that may be one way it got its name. There's also the theory that when it came to England, it was called, the French called it, I'm sorry, I don't know French, contra dance. It was, and the English corrupted it into contra dance because the French were calling it the country dance, and then the English corrupted it. So you can take either one of those about how it's got its name. Today when we're dancing it, of course, cultural traditions evolve and change. Today when we're dancing it, the men are lined up across from the women, but we actually alternate. So as you're going down the line, it's a man, a woman, man, woman, man, woman, with a partner across from them in a line facing them. And you're dancing with your partner, but you're also dancing with other people up and down the line. If you've ever seen the movie... Oh, it's one of the Leather Stocking Tales, Last of the Mohicans. If you saw that movie, there's a fort scene, and in the background you can see dancers dancing in the firelight. The dance that they're doing is contra dance, because that's what they were doing. That's what George Washington was doing. That's what Thomas Jefferson was doing. If you had come here to the Valley in 1800, gone down to Jonathan, well, he wasn't there quite that early, but if you'd gone to Jonathan Hale's farm in the early 1800s, and he was playing the fiddle, you would have been dancing contra dances. If you'd gone down to the Mustel store, to Fred and Emma Mustel's place, and they were having one of their kitchen dances, you would have been dancing contra dances. It's what people danced. Fashions changed, squares came in, then this scandalous thing called the waltz came in, and things changed and evolved. And after a while, contra dance kind of died out. And then in the 1970s, there was a revival in it, and a group was restarted here. And now, we're doing the tradition that was actually a tradition that started in England, was brought over to young America, and then moved west, and eventually found its way into Ohio, because we were settled by people from New England. So we're dancing something that's been seen here for over 200 years. When you're dancing the contra dance, the first thing you'll hear a caller say is line up for a contra. And you take your partner, whoever you've asked or whoever's asked you for that dance, because we're not square dancers, we don't stay with the same partner throughout the whole, we'll ask different people. But you take your partner and you line up. People, they start at what they say is the top of the hall nearest the music, and they line up down the hall in long lines across from your partner. The way they line up initially is the men are on one side and the women are on the other. And then invariably, the caller these days, unless they're dancing an older dance, which they will dance some older dances from time to time, or something that's a little mixed up, they'll say hands four. Or somebody on the line will start yelling, hands four. And what happens then is that people start squaring off in little groups of four. And as they're doing that, the caller will probably say actives cross over or ones cross over, and the people that are closest to the caller in that little group of four will switch places. So now the line starts he, she, he, she, and it's across from she, he. I don't know if that's making sense or not, but you're alternating. You're going to dance with your partner, but you're also going to be doing other moves with other people in the line. And as the line evolves or as the music plays, you wind up doing something called progressing. So if you're a one or an active, you wind up going down the hall. So you get to dance with everybody. One of the ways that I got my boyfriend to come in now to dance is I convinced him to come dance because every 55 seconds you have a new woman in your arms because you're constantly dancing with the whole group. If you remember middle school, going to gym class and they taught the Virginia Reel, that's actually a very, very, very old contra dance. So you were dancing a contra dance even then. It's a community dance. It's a dance that the moves are probably some things you're familiar with from square dancing. Element left, element right, swing your partner, do-si-do. But we mix them up, and we keep ourselves limited to a very small number of calls, unlike square dancing, which can have 120, and you have to know what each line means. We have the same 16 calls, and we just keep mixing them up into new dance forms. There is a caller, I should tell you that tells you what to do each moment. So each moment, every time the move changes, they'll tell you. Long lines go forward and back, active swing, ladies chain. So they'll tell you what each move is, and then they'll have so many calls, and then they start repeating. And so they're doing a figure all the way through.
What kinds of music are you listening to?
It's called old time, and it's a specific type of old time music. The tunes, and I did not know this when I started dancing, the tunes are actually tunes that are written in what's called an A-B form. There's 64 beats of A music, and then 64 beats of B music, and then they repeat. 64 beats of A music, and 60. So they keep repeating, and within those beats, you're doing the moves. Each move is, usually the moves are 8 or 16 counts long, so you can listen to the music and, ooh, something's not right, and get yourself back with the music. Surprisingly enough, there's some interesting A-B tunes out there. The instruments often are like hammer dulcimer, fiddle. We have had piano, guitar, harmonica. They're the old-time instruments that you think of, kind of almost bluegrassy instruments. But they're following in a set repertoire of that A-B music. Maybe they're playing Arkansas Traveler, if you've ever heard that one. Maybe they're playing Dusty Miller. Maybe they're playing, I'm trying to think, there's some funny ones that I have danced to. For those people who are from Cleveland, there was a movie or a television show, Gilardi. I'm not familiar with it, but it comes out that the theme song from that is actually an A-B tune, as is Secret Agent Man is an A-B tune. So we've danced to some odd ones, but they're played in that style, that old-time fiddle music style.
So what is it like to do the contra dance in some of these historic places, like the Everett Road Covered Bridge? Why is that special?
The Everett Road Covered Bridge is a special dance. We actually, I don't know how long that one's been going on. I think 12, 13, 14 years. And it's done on the Everett Road Covered Bridge. There's something about being in a historic structure and doing a dance form that people have been doing for hundreds of years that it evokes a sense of place, it evokes a sense of nostalgia. But so, what is it about dancing on the Everett Road Covered Bridge? There's something about dancing in a historic structure, in doing a dance that's been done, a dance form, I should say, that's been done for hundreds of years, that evokes a sense of nostalgia, but also a sense of place. There's a uniqueness to the Everett Road Covered Bridge dance because, as you may know, the Everett Road Covered Bridge was a public road. It was the public road, the way to get across the creek, Furnace Run. And for this dance, we closed the bridge off. And I think this dance has been done for 12 or 15 years on that bridge, but that's not the first time dances have been done in Everett. They used to close the street in Everett. And, here's a public road, a county road. I think that one's maintained by the county. And they closed the road, and they would have this dance. They would bring the musicians out on a hay wagon and play, and people are dancing in the street. It truly was a street festival. So there's a historicity there. There's a length of time where people have been doing that. We also dance in the Boston Township Hall, and I have images of people dancing in the Boston Township Hall in the 1930s and the 1940s. And yes, they're doing squares, but every once in a while they'll throw in what they thought was a chestnut and do a contra dance. So they're doing the kinds of dancing that had been done in the Valley for a long time, and now here we are doing them again. And the other thing is, one of the great things about dancing, even in historic structures, it's just plain fun. You're dancing with human beings. It doesn't matter if black, blue, purple, white, yellow, it doesn't matter. We see a variety of people. We see everything from truck drivers to doctors to park rangers to people who, oh yeah, I'm now unemployed. There's this range of socioeconomic. There's a range, and it's fun. We see college kids. We see one guy comes and dances who's 75 years old. So there's this wide range of people, and we're all dancing together in this historic structure with this great ambiance. And the great thing about the Everett Road Covered Bridge and the Boston Township Hall is they're wood floors. That's, for a dancer, that's a big deal.
Why is that a big deal?
For me personally, it's a big deal because I'm getting older and my knees can't dance on concrete. It's a softer surface. And dancing on wood, human beings weren't meant to dance on stone or concrete. It just tears up your knees after a while. And here's this great wood floor at the Boston Township Hall. And yeah, the surface is rougher at a road-covered bridge, but you're dancing on water, which is kind of this cool thing to look down between the boards as you're swinging and the creek's running.
Okay. So can you just, I guess, broadly explain what was the, the impact of the canal for, I know it's a huge question, but if you could briefly kind of sum up the biggest kind of changes that happened in the Valley.
In the
Valley, I'm not necessarily Cleveland or Akron, but like for maybe farming families here. Or
what are the biggest changes that the canal brought to the Valley? One of the first things we see is we see property values go haywire. From the time that they proposed the route of the canal till 7 years later when the canal was completed, property values go up like 160%. People were buying today at a low price, selling high tomorrow. So we may think that, you know, here in 2011, that flipping houses is a new thing, but no, they were doing it even then. They called it speculation. So they're speculating, they're buying. So we see that. That's first one of the things that we see. We see property values go up. But when the work crews come in and they start digging the canal, the other thing that we start to see is the state of Ohio was paying its contractors, who then paid their workers, in cash. We see hard currency. This was a barter economy here in the Valley before that, but now there's cash. The other thing that the canal starts to do almost immediately is we got cash, we see property values going up, and the canal, even along its proposed routes before it's open, starts bringing in new people. Whereas before, you knew everybody in your neighborhood, you understood the language, you understood the words. Now you have maybe a German work crew. They speak another entirely different language. And maybe there's an Irish group that speaks almost the same, but there's this heavy Irish brogue you have to get through, and some of their wording is different. So you've got all these new people right in front of your door that you don't have any history with. When the canal opens in 1827, other things start happening. And again, this is just here in the Valley, because the first section to complete was between Akron and Cleveland. You start seeing almost immediately, and I do think that it was within it was either 24 or 30-hour period, in Cleveland, the price of grain went from a quarter a bushel to a dollar a bushel. It was like, for one morning, like July 3rd, it was a quarter a bushel. And then after the canal opened, by the evening of the 4th of July, grain is going for a dollar a bushel. Like, and it stays there. It doesn't back down. So immediately you see more money if you're a farmer. You see now we can ship the goods. And so you start seeing all these goods flowing out of Ohio, going up across Lake Erie, down the Erie Canal to New York. We start feeding New York City instead of New York City buying its grain from Asia. Not Asia. Eastern Europe. My apologies. So you start seeing goods going out. The other side of that is goods start coming in. We start seeing China, match sets of China. Maybe they're, you know, the English pottery coming in. We start seeing, oh, yeah, that newfangled kitchen appliance, the wood-burning stove. We start seeing milled cotton, cotton coming from the mills in the east, all this fabric. For example, up at Canal Visitor Center, one of the great excitements at Lock 38 one time was Mrs. Gleason had a piano delivered. You know, imagine a grand key piano coming down on a boat, and then they have to actually put it on a wagon and drag it up a hill. But you start seeing things flow right by your front door. It's not just goods. You're seeing ideas. Now, where it had used to take 6 weeks to 2 months to get news from the nation's capital, now you knew what was happening in Federal City or Federal Town within a week. So the world gets smaller, news speeds up, people speed up. Now people can travel to Louisville if they want to, or all the way down to New Orleans by boat. And it's safer than the old Natchez Trace. So the world gets smaller, but the world gets bigger almost immediately.
Can you explain how the canal and the locks actually worked?
The reason that they needed a canal is there are waterways throughout Ohio. You know, right here we have the Cuyahoga River, and the Cuyahoga, there's a short portage over to the Tuscarawas, then the Muskingum. So there's waterways, but the problem with the waterways is sometimes they're 4 foot deep, sometimes they're 4 inches, sometimes it's really dry. Oh, yeah, and between Akron and Cleveland, it's actually Cleveland to Akron, you have to go up 395 feet. So to do that, it wasn't feasible for water travel. And a canal, by digging a canal, they create a man-made ditch that by law has to be 4 feet deep. And then whenever there's an elevation change of significant amount, they put in an elevator for boats, if you will. They put in a lock. And when I work with children, I tell them that a lock is just like being in the bathtub. You want your rubber ducky higher in the tub, you put more water in. You want your rubber ducky lower in the tub, you let the water out. That's what a lock does in its most quintessentialist simplicity. If a boat wants to go upstream and go up the elevation, it's obviously coming from Cleveland. It comes into the lock. There are gates at either end that are closed. And then at the higher end, they let in water, which raises the boat up. Once the water level's the same at the higher elevation as it is inside the lock, they open up the gates on that end and the boat goes out. If a boat wants to go down in elevation, it has to come from the higher elevation, obviously, goes in the lock, the doors get shut behind it, they let water into the lock, and the way they're letting the water in is it's inside these gates. There are valves, they're called butterfly valves or wickets. And they're just openings that you open up inside this big gate, and it lets the water in. So they let the water out. Sorry, they let the water out, and if it's going downstream, let the water out. The boat goes down. When the water level on both ends is the same, they open up the gates, and it goes out. So when you're constructing a canal, you're putting these at regular intervals. So the boat goes level, takes a step up, level, takes a step up, and the water level is maintained by putting dams on nearby rivers, and they feed the water in and then let the water out at various places to keep it the same constant level to ensure the traffic flow.
And there were whole families that lived on canal boats, or who was on the canal boats?
It depends on when you're there. In the early days, when the canal was in its glory, and I'm going to say, even though the canal had some great financial difficulties in the 1840s and 1850s, I'm going to say that I'm going to be loose here in my definitions and say that it's in its glory till 1862 or so, because 1862 is the year that we see the highest amount of traffic on the canal. So it's still being widely used. in the early days, probably up to that time, if you were on a canal boat, more than likely you had a professional crew. And professional crew more than likely meant largely male. The captain might have owned the boat, or he might have been running the boat for another company. And there's a crew. There's drovers. There's oarsmen. I'm sorry, the person who's steering the boat. You have people with different jobs. You probably do have a cook. That might be the only female on the boat. I have seen pictures of crews that are working boats. It's an all-male crew. The cook is African-American. So you get, it's mostly a professional crew. But then after the Civil War, people return to using the railroads. The railroad is coming into its heyday and its prime. The canal falls into disuse, starts a long decline. It actually is privatized, so it's maintained by private hands. It's maybe not maintained as well as it could. Things go downhill. People are still using the canal because it's slow and steady. Then we see more and more lists of people running boats. There's dad, there's mom, and then there's 3, 4, 6, 12, whatever the number of kids that they have. So you're, pardon me, literally growing your own crew. So there is a switch at some point. When that happens, when the passenger packets stop, except for pleasure excursions, and when the freight's moving slower, then you have the switch over to the family-owned boats.
Is the Tinker's Creek, the aqueduct, is that related to the canals? I don't know anything about the aqueduct. I just see it on the map.
Aqueduct. The problem is, so you're creating a man-made body of water, a man-made ditch, if you will. And it's going, and they have to follow relatively close to a river. Well, you can't find a river that has all of its creeks on one side. So there's going to be creeks coming in. And anytime you have a creek or a run or a brook running in from the side, you can't, oftentimes that creek or brook or run may be lower than the canal, or it may be flood prone. It might have issues. Maybe it's the same level, but you don't want water suddenly flowing into this area. So sometimes what they had to do is they actually had to build a bridge for the canal over a body of water. And that's what an aqueduct is. You know, if you think about the classic Roman aqueducts, they're bringing water in from high up in the mountains into, say, the city of Rome. They're carrying water on these high elevated bridges. Well, this is the same thing. We're carrying water over a lower body of water. Because if we let those intermingle, we're not going to get our water level back up to that 4-foot high level that we need that's predictable and managed. One of the best places to see that is in Peninsula. There was an aqueduct right there, and it's a dramatic place because the river is significantly lower at that point than the aqueduct.
Do you know how many aqueducts there were in the valley?
Ooh, that's a very good question. There's more than two. Tinker's Creek is the first one that comes to mind. I believe there was one at Sagamore. There's one at Peninsula. There had to be one at Furnace Run. There may have been more. I don't have those numbers on the top of my head.
Do you know if the same people building the canal, were they the ones building the aqueducts as well?
What you would have is when the state let the contracts back in 1825, they let the contracts and a contractor would pick up various pieces to work on. Maybe a contractor might pick up three pieces. Maybe one's Newark and two are here. They pick up those pieces and then they hire subcontractors to manage those individual pieces. And if you have an individual piece, say from mile 23 to mile 27, and there's two locks and an aqueduct within there, your crew, you have to have masons, carpenters, and grunts that are going to do the every, that's not what they call them, but you're going to have people that can do the backbreaking work of lifting and dragging the mud and the dirt out of the way. So if when you got the contract for a specific area, you may have one aqueduct. and three locks, you might have three locks and no aqueduct. Or you might be really lucky and have a long, flat stretch, like down towards Pickaway, that has nothing but canal.
The canal visitor center that was called Hell's Half Acre.
That is a name. Unfortunately, the sign in front of there leads you to believe that that was the name that it was called during the canal era. When that structure was purchased by Moses Gleason, and I believe it was about 1837, Moses Gleason was an upstanding man, highly thought of in the Bedford community. He was an Episcopalian. Now, I don't know if they were, you know, regular, everyday, Sunday-going-to-church people, but they were fine, upstanding members of the community. And their hope was to have a tavern and a store there, a respectable business. So I don't know that it had its name then. I don't think it did, because eventually he got a son-in-law to run it who ran it for a year, and the son-in-law didn't want to run it, so he gave it to another son, and eventually becomes a residence. So it's a rather quiet place. You know, people are living there. There's other businesses that are used there. But it does actually acquire a bit of a reputation starting in the mid-1920s, which, if you may remember, was the era of Prohibition. And there is good, there's some oral history, some stories, and some indication that the area, that particular structure may have had a speakeasy in the basement, or if not a speakeasy, at least it was a place where you could procure some fine spirits. And then it starts getting, and I've even heard in oral histories and hand-me-down stories, that there were some ladies who chose alternative means of making a living, not in the usual upright fashion, and that because of that, it starts getting this reputation. And actually, in the 1950s, a motorcycle gang was even living there. So the reputation just kind of kept continuing for a while.
The two other potential sites for our project were the Frazee House and Brandywine mm-hmm. Falls. So, I mean, are there, I guess with Brandywine Falls, if you want to start with that, is there a particular, history or stories or anything?
Brandywine Falls was actually maybe settled about the same time as Boston, but initially Brandywine Falls had a greater potential than Boston because they have the waterfalls. If you have a waterfall in 1806, you have power. You can capture the energy of that falling water. There's a grist mill. There's a sawmill. There's a woolen mill. Industry springs up there. Well, you know, of course, then there's even a distillery at one point. And the beverage that they made was so good, it was called Brandywine. There you, before you get this name, Brandywine Falls. So there's a lot. Early on, we see a great potential there. And we actually have images from 1850s, 1860s, 1870s. There's industry there. There is that grist mill, woolen mill, sawmill. There are things there. Unfortunately, when the canal comes through, Boston now has a means for getting things out, so they soon eclipse Brandywine. Brandywine, well, and Boston too, both went through some boom and bust cycles. Brandywine, you know, was the early rising, shining star, but was eclipsed by Boston when the canal came through. Brandywine starts to decline a little. George Wallace was the primary settler and instigator of things there. But in later years, Brandywine gets rediscovered and becomes a hopping place to be again, because during the 1930s, I believe his name was William Somers, S-O-M-M-E-R-S, this is where he chose to come to paint, to relax, and it becomes kind of an artist colony. So it kind of goes through a resurgence again. And about that same time, they also had the Champion Electric Company there. And if you owned a hot dog cooker or various restaurant appliances in Cleveland at that time, they may have come from the Champion Electric Company that manufactured them. So it kind of went through a second little rebirth or renaissance there.
And the Frazee House?
Frazee House, I have to say, is one of my favorite stories in the park. Stephen and Mehitable Frazee moved here in the early 1800s. There's a great deal of discussion about when they got here. There's references that Stephen Frazee may have been here as early as 1811. We see him buying land. They're in and around, but where they are exactly, you know, unfortunately, we don't have all the records from back then. But eventually, they do live on that property. They live in a log cabin. And sometime shortly before the canal comes through, Stephen Frazee starts the process of building a house. He's going to build a house because they are an established family here. They're a respectable middle-class family. And he starts building a house in the style that he remembers from his youth as the sign of prosperity. It's a Federal-style house. And I say they started slightly before the canal because if you're going to build something that size, you have to get the goods together before you start building. So, because it isn't until 1825 that we see a marked increase in the house or in the property value, and there's indications that it's due to a dwelling on the tax records. So he may have been already well into the construction process at that point. So he builds this Federal-style house. And when I'm talking to kids, I talk about, you know, imagine mom or dad coming home one day and saying, "Hey, kids, I bought the Martha Stewart Guide to Housing, and we're going to build this house right here." And, you know, if you're familiar with Martha Stewart, so she tells you how to make it beautiful, and she gives you the patterns, but it doesn't necessarily help tell you how to put in the plumbing or what to do if you encounter this bedrock when you shouldn't, when it should be, you know, loamy soil. So he had this builder's guide, the American Builder's Companion, which had the fashion that he wanted. And then he built this house with nothing but himself, maybe a hired laborer or two, and his kids, and they built this house. And if you've ever seen it, it's an imposing two-story brick house. And it says to the world, we have arrived. They lived in that house until about the start of the Civil War when Mehitable Frazee dies. You're married to the same one for half a century. Losing that half of yourself is pretty traumatic. Shortly after that, Stephen Frazee sells the property. He doesn't give it to his sons. He sells it. He divides the money, gives money to his various children, and including grandchildren, because one set of grandchildren had lost their parents. He gives a larger chunk to one daughter in particular because that's the daughter that he's going to live with. And he goes and lives with that daughter. And the individual that buys the house is a man by the name of John Hyten. Buys it in 1861, enjoys it for 4 years, adds on to it. 1865, Mr. Hyten passes away, leaving his wife, Elizabeth Hyten. Or some people call it Hinton, but I understand from the descendants that they prefer to be called Hyten. She then proceeds to run the farm. And by 1870, she has one of the largest farms in production in that area. She's running it with a son-in-law and some kids, and it's not without controversy. She eventually dies. It goes to another owner who has it a very short time, and then it goes to the Foote family, who are the ones that have it when the Park Service acquires it. That's part of the uniqueness of the story of the Frazee House. What, four owners in 175, 180 years? The inside of the house saw very, very little structural change. They didn't knock down walls. They didn't replumb this. They didn't, bless her heart, when Mrs. Foote, Agnes Foote, got rid of the house, she had one room that had running water, electricity, and heat. So that none of the rest of the house had been configured greatly for stuff like that. So we hadn't seen a great deal of modern upgrading. So here's this structure that's almost intact from the time it was built. And it's, you know, I don't know about you, I can't get my tent to stay up all night sometimes. And here's a house that stood for 180 years. As a testament, this is one family's dream of a better life. And there it is.
Questions.
Cool.